This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Election 2018 is over. Democrats have made some gains nationwide and in Michigan, while Republicans held on in some key races, both in the U.S. and in this state as well. We're going to discuss those with Western Michigan University political science professors Peter Wielhauer and John Clark. Thank you again both for being here.
Glad to be here.
Happy to be here.
So we're going to start here with this 20th state Senate district. The Gongwer News Service had said that this was a real test of candidates where you have an incumbent running who seems to have done all the right things versus the political environment, which seemed to favor Democrats. And it turns out that Sean McCann won that district by 12,000 votes after losing it by just 64 years ago. Can we take that out maybe a little bit to other races, that this was a good test of what the political environment means for races up and down the ballot?
Sure. When candidates are making decisions, they're looking at what they feel is the temperature of the country and the temperature of their district. And I think that the temperature of Michigan, in political terms, may not be the same as the temperature of other states and other places. But I think that for Kalamazoo County, but for much of the rest of the state, this was not a good year for Donald Trump in Michigan. And that has ramifications up and down the ballot. Now, it wasn't just about Donald Trump, certainly. This was a good year for Democrats. We always expect the out party, the party that doesn't control the White House, to do well in the first midterm especially. But this was an especially good year for Michigan. And there were a bunch of other things happening that made it a good year for Democrats in Kalamazoo County. And, you know, we saw that not only in the state Senate race, but in some of the county commission races and whatnot. So absolutely, the political environment made this a difficult year for a candidate like Margaret O'Brien, who did about as much as you could do to represent this county from a bipartisan perspective as a Republican in a very partisan legislature where there isn't much room for bipartisan maneuvering.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that when you're looking at a county that is traditionally kind of bifurcated, where we have the liberal kind of pocket in Kalamazoo City and then more conservative elements surrounding the city in the rural areas and in Portage, it's a difficult place for a candidate to win strongly. And I think that her efforts to work in the legislature to identify those areas, such as with dealing with Larry Nassar kind of legislation and so forth, dealing with the environmental issues that came up with PFAS, those were about the best thing that she could possibly do. But I do see that here in Kalamazoo County, part of the landscape that is harder to predict is the level of excitement that the parties are going to have in any given year. So certainly there's a reliable base of the parties from year to year. But what we saw this year is just tremendous energy on the side of the Democratic Party, and in particular in the college students at Western and in other schools like Kalamazoo College as well. Here at Western, we had a really robust We Vote campaign with one of our colleagues, Denise Keel. They registered a lot of new voters in Kalamazoo. And I don't know that all of them voted in Kalamazoo County, but just the infusion of an additional 2,000 young voters into the electorate, many of whom we can presume actually voted, that had to make a difference in terms of something that a year out could not have been predicted by a conventional campaign like Margaret O'Brien was probably running.
And, you know, the lines at the Bernhard Center, which is not where all students vote, and there are other people that vote there as well, suggests that turnout was robust here in the county and probably statewide as well in other parts of the state where younger voters, you know, as people who are teaching this stuff and thinking about this stuff all the time, people often say to us, oh, this must be a great time to be a political scientist. And, you know, my response always is, well, it's always a great time to be a political scientist, but right now you're interested in the things that I'm interested in every day. And usually we see a real downturn in interest among our students and, you know, the people that we interact with in the community after the presidential election is over. That hasn't really happened. It's stayed. The level of interest in politics has stayed at a high level. And I think that we know that voting is habitual. It's certainly conceivable that we've created or are beginning to create a sort of new group of voters. And it will be interesting to see what they do as they age, how they continue to be engaged in the process and the kinds of choices that they continue to make moving forward.
Well, and what life does to them, because sure. life experience introduces new concepts, new pressures, new economic realities, as most of them will end up getting married and having children and buying houses and going in, you know, trying to pay off their student loans. Who governs and who manages a lot of the practical questions helps to solidify people within one political party or the other. You know, I think one of the things that's important for us to talk about here is this question about voter turnout. Here in Kalamazoo County, as best I can tell, is we are looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of 58% voter turnout in terms of the registered voters who cast votes in the congressional race. That's presidential level year. That is not midterm year, in which 45 to 48% is more typical. That's a big difference. And you know, to the extent to which voter turnout is associated with a Democratic advantage, that certainly would be a piece of the puzzle that helped Sean McCann beat Margaret O'Brien, but also that made other races like Brent Iden's race much more competitive than what might have been expected.
And also probably made the congressional race where Matt Longjohn came as close as any Democrat has ever come to the defeating Republican Congressman Fred Upton. The turnout certainly played a role in making that race more competitive as well.
Absolutely.
And helping Matt Longjohn to win Kalamazoo County for the first time that any of the three of us could remember that the Democrat won Kalamazoo County in the sixth.
And winning it significantly. And I'm wondering if this maybe is, we're talking about political realignments. I mean, is Kalamazoo County somewhat realigned here? I think when I moved here, Kalamazoo County was kind of considered a moderate Republican Party over time. It's probably been trending a bit more purple. After this, do we look at Kalamazoo County, again, small sample size, and say, well, Kalamazoo County's blue?
I think it's a little early to make that declaration. Certainly, when political scientists talk about things like realignments, we expect them to be longstanding, and that usually means we can't tell whether things have realigned until after they've unrealigned. We've moved on to the next one. But I do think there are some interesting changes going on in the parties that make Kalamazoo County an interesting microcosm of what we might see in other places. As recently as 4 years ago with the midterm, we could pretty reasonably say that the city of Kalamazoo was heavily Democratic, the rest of the county was heavily Republican, and they were roughly the same size. With this election, part of what we have seen is what we think we've seen, and of course we're recording this, it's still back of the envelope kind of calculations.
Right.
We've seen an influx, we think, of younger voters who don't necessarily have the same kinds of vote choices in mind as their parents. And we've also seen some changes among college-educated white voters that we have traditionally thought of as being part of the Republican base in suburban areas like Portage and Kalamazoo County, but you know, lots of places in the country. And the direction of the Republican Party has not been a direction that oftentimes appeals to those kinds of voters. And so to the extent to which there's kind of that suburban white realignment, we will see that in Kalamazoo. And this is a community that has a high level of education, in part because of the educational institutions that are here, in part because of the industries that have traditionally been an important part of the economy in Kalamazoo County. And so it very well could be the case, if it's more than a single election or two kind of, one-off, two-off kind of change, if it does become a permanent change to the underlying coalitions of the two major parties. Kalamazoo County will be a great microcosm of that, and we very well could see the county become much more reliably Democratic than it has been in the past.
Well, I think that when we look at how these differences play out in practical matter for both Michigan and for the nation as a whole, we can identify through exit polls and through other kinds of survey research the divide that's growing between men and women in terms of those who are college educated, those who are not college educated. And we know that Donald Trump brought in and mobilized into the Republican voting coalition non-college educated white men and brought them and prompted them to vote at rates at which they simply hadn't voted in recent memory. At the same time, the course of the last 2 years has seen a really steady bleeding of college-educated white women away from Republicans. This is a traditionally Republican cohort. but they're kind of going against what they're seeing the president do. And so that has consequences for other people who are in the political who are running under the party label. And then they, to the extent to which that party label becomes associated with the president, that's going to hurt them, even if they try to separate themselves from the president's less desirable kind of comments. It creates a pressure on them in the voting process.
And if we take that a step further, can we also say that perhaps that gender divide played itself out on the ballot, where we saw women at the top of the ticket, elected governor of Michigan, elected attorney general, elected secretary of state. We saw it in other states as well. But is that one way that it manifests itself, that female candidates are perhaps more likely to run, maybe more likely to win the Democratic nomination, and once they're on the ballot in the general election, perhaps a little more likely to actually be elected?
I think as we go back 2 years, the campaign of Donald Trump, his comments about women, and the general approach that he takes toward issues that are more concern to women than they are to men, we know that there was a burst of energy in terms of women seeking political office, running in primaries to win the nominations, and then once the primaries were done, in terms of winning, running for offices around the country to a much greater extent than we've seen in U.S. history. So we just have more women candidates running. So when you have more women candidates running, almost by definition, more women candidates will win. I think what's remarkable is that the extent to which those women are winning, the rate at which they're winning, the margins by which they're winning, I think matters a lot. And I think looking at the top of the Michigan ticket, all of those statewide seats, except for Gary Peters, I mean, they're all women, and they're all Democrats.
One of the important things to keep in mind as well, though, is it isn't just that they're women. These are highly qualified women.
Excellent.
The Republican women that won across the country in this election cycle as well were not political novices. Men are much more likely to win in their first attempt at elective office. When women are running for office and you know, we start to just identify them as statewide candidates, we see them running for Congress or for the United States Senate, the ones that are successful are ones who have paid their dues at lower levels. And so they are not coming into this with a dearth of political experience. They're coming in with excellent resumes.
Excellent.
That's a big difference as well. But now we're seeing that in lots of states, there's a bench that's forming of Republican and Democratic women state legislators. They're running on, you know, for city commissions. They're running for lots of offices, and they're starting to see the opportunities to move up the ladder until we see them running for, you know, for the United States Congress or for statewide office.
So if there was a surprise at the top of the ticket in Michigan, it would have been that Debbie Stabenow did not win by more. She had a very close race with John James. To draw maybe a little too crude of a parallel, is John James the Beto O'Rourke of Michigan and of the Republican Party, someone who took on an incumbent where it didn't look like it was going to be a competitive race? And now I think probably people today may be asking themselves, well, you know, what's the political future for John James after running such a competitive race when most people were really not paying attention to this very much during the fall?
You know, I think what we ended up seeing across all of the statewide races is that folks who voted for Gretchen Whitmer for governor voted for the other Democratic candidates on the ticket. And the same thing on the Republican side. It seems as though, if just looking in the sort of the aggregate totals, not drilling too deep yet, but it seems as though the U.S. Senate race turned out to be sort of a typical Democrat versus Republican race in a year that was a good year for Democrats.
Right. But actually, Gretchen Whitmer did better than Debbie Stabenow statewide. So there had to be some ticket splitting that was going on somewhere that was getting John James a little better numbers than you would expect.
Well, I think here we've got some a question about kind of excitement on the Republican side and excitement on the Democratic side. And I think that there was a real lack of enthusiasm for Bill Schuette as a candidate. So you had Republicans who went in and voted and maybe were not very excited about Schuette and maybe didn't vote for Schuette, maybe voted for the Libertarian instead. But then I saw a great deal of excitement for John James. Where I live down in Texas Township, there were tons of John James signs and almost no Bill Schuette signs. So I would see yard after yard after yard with a lot of Republican signs, except for Bill Schuette. So I think that there's something in terms of the general enthusiasm for him. We have to wait a little while to kind of get more nuanced numbers on this. I mean, I'd like to see, you know, in the counties where there's a greater minority population that are historically strong Democratic counties, did John James make inroads in those counties as an African-American candidate? You know, is that something that the Republicans ought to be learning from in the future? You know, when we talked after the primaries, I said that one of the things that the Republicans did best in the primaries was nominating John James. I think that that's an opportunity for Republicans and a lesson learned that if they're going to make progress in a politically diverse and a demographically diverse state like Michigan, they can't just stick with old white guys. They've got to expand the candidate base into to a greater extent of minority candidates, working with relationships with the minority community, which is very difficult to do if you're just an old school Republican.
It looks as though, while you're talking, Pete, I was just pulling up some numbers very quickly. It looks as though in Wayne County, for instance, a traditional Democratic bastion, John James got about 27% of the vote, mm-hmm. which seems pretty good until you realize that Bill Schuette got 25% of the vote. So, you know, again, not that much difference. I think you're right, though, that he became, many of us expected, I don't want to speak for either of you, but early on expected that to the extent of which John James was successful, he was going to be riding Bill Schuette's coattails.
Yep.
Instead, in some ways, it became the reverse. He became the face of the Republican Party statewide, whereas Schuette was not nearly as visible as many of us expected him to be. I mean, here's somebody that's been running for governor for a really long time. And it turned out that when he finally had his opportunity, he didn't show very much.
Yeah. Well, I think that Schuette's effort to try to distance himself from his Donald Trump endorsement probably didn't really sell.
Well, right? Especially because he used it extensively during the primary. He had a competitive primary that you got to win that before to get to the general.
Right.
So. Exactly. So that would not have helped Bill Schuette. But ironically, I think that probably it did help John James because Donald Trump continued to express his support for John James throughout the general election. And I think that probably did help him to gain Republican votes from those folks who might have been not so hot on the general Republican ticket.
Speaking of the lack of enthusiasm, Peter, that you mentioned for Bill Schuette, or perceived lack of enthusiasm, Governor Rick Snyder did not endorse Bill Schuette for governor. There's a lot of reasons for that, and I suppose you could argue maybe it wouldn't have made much difference. Rick Snyder's not terribly popular at the moment. Still, though, how unusual is that a sitting governor does not endorse the candidate of his party, especially when he is making endorsements in other races, but says, I'm not going to make an endorsement there. I'm too busy being governor, I think was what he said.
I think it's hard to say. I think endorsements are a mixed bag. Sometimes they help and sometimes they don't help. And it's difficult to identify systematic patterns of this. I did not follow that endorsement drama as much maybe I should have. But it could just as easily have been Bill Schuette saying, you're going to be a drag on me, this whole Flint water thing, you look bad in that. And Schuette saw the Flint water handling as a strong suit. And so on his own resume, it was something that said, I did pursue these criminal charges against people who were implicated in the Flint water crisis. So I think he saw that as something that was a genuine positive for him, and that I think he might have seen that as a drag for Rick Snyder. So I don't know the extent to which he maybe said, you know, I don't need your endorsement, or I don't want your endorsement. It provides too much of a mixed message for me. On the other hand, Rick Snyder is not a terribly strong Republican. I mean, he's a Republican, but before he ran for office, he wasn't really a Republican. So it's difficult to say kind of how much weight his endorsement really would carry with the base.
And I think the fact that he didn't endorse didn't have the impact that it would have if he had endorsed Gretchen Whitmer. To the extent to which we see endorsements that are out of character and unexpected, that becomes much more newsworthy. People tend to think about them and pay attention to them a lot more. And we certainly saw some of those in this election cycle in other parts of the mm-hmm. country, where people were, you know, sort of denouncing their family members and things like that. But I think the absence of the endorsement probably didn't make much difference in the outcome, simply for some of the reasons that Pete said, and simply because most voters probably didn't know that Snyder made any endorsements or didn't pay much attention to that.
John, earlier this year, you and I did a segment on ballot proposals and whether or not sometimes ballot proposals can help candidates. Maybe sometimes candidates help ballot proposals. If we look at the three that passed in Michigan, legalizing recreational marijuana, an independent redistricting commission, and then one which is said to promote voter access, do you think that there is any relationship that you can see there or a correlation where either those passed because this was a good Democratic year or that those ballot proposals might have made it a better Democratic year in Michigan?
I think it's not unreasonable to think that they made it a better Democratic year and that they mobilized some folks who perhaps wouldn't have voted previously. And for the latter two, because they were sort of viewed as good government proposals at a time when Republicans controlled all of the levers within the state of Michigan, that might have helped Democrats among folks who didn't always think of themselves as being Democrats. But I think in part, too, it's what we in political science would call a spurious relationship, that the causal factor is less about one influencing the other, but rather this infusion of younger voters and a new generation of voters into the mix. Some of those folks didn't view these issues, I suspect, as partisan issues. Mm-hmm. Some of them sort of assumed that all of the politicians are bad guys, and we saw that in John James' television commercials. Mm-hmm. I hate politicians. I'm, you know,
all of them.
Yeah,
right.
All of them, including apparently the Republican. Well, not himself, right? Because he's not a politician. And so, but this idea that that all politicians are bad was very much part of Donald Trump's appeal in 2016, and Bernie Sanders' appeal as well. Although, you know, again, he was an outsider, but he was an outsider who sits in the United States Senate and continues to sit there. I think that has sort of multiple layers to it. One is that we sort of think of ballot proposals oftentimes as starting from people saying no, and then you have to sort of overcome that. But I suspect that for folks who are not longtime voters, the idea that there's something on the ballot, you're sort of interested in it, you vote on it, just like, you know, without sort of thinking about the way the governmental system works, without sort of thinking about, okay, this is a way of bypassing the legislature. It's a good idea. I think it's a good idea. I'm going to vote for it. So I suspect that there was a fair amount of that as well. And with each of these proposals, it'll be interesting to see how we implement them, because we don't necessarily know what these are going to look like once they are fully implemented. We know what the ideas are, but not necessarily the implementation. And again, that's something that I suspect many younger voters and first-time voters don't really spend a lot of time thinking about.
And proposals 2 and 3 could actually impact future elections, or should impact future elections if they're supposed to.
Absolutely.
Well,
they will.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. Yeah, I think that, you know, the infusion of young voters, when we think about these three ballot proposals, the first one, we can kind of stereotype young voters. But then we look at the other two ballot proposals, and just on the surface, if we came at those proposals without any kind of a partisan lens, they seem pretty reasonable on the surface. And I think that even though there are plausible arguments against particularly ballot proposal 2 on gerrymandering, I think that the big selling points that the opponents were trying to make were not the selling points that would matter to young people. So the idea that liberals are the ones bankrolling and supporting it, like Barack Obama, well, for young people, that's like, oh, is that a plus or a minus? I mean, I like Barack Obama, yeah, so that's probably, right, you know, a good thing. And so I think sometimes the messaging that was coming from the opponents was not necessarily something that's going to resonate with a younger cohort of voters.
It's interesting that when we look at the governor's race, the United States Senate race, if we look at a map of counties, the counties that went Democratic were primarily the counties that are large urban rural counties went Republican, as they did in the 2016 presidential election.
And often counties with a university there is a big factor as well. Kalamazoo,
correct.
Ingham County, Washtenaw County.
Correct.
Yep.
But if you look at Proposal 1, it was pretty successful in many parts of the state that otherwise supported Republican candidates. Right. And so, again, it wasn't viewed as a partisan issue, but it may have helped in certain places. It may have helped Democratic candidates to be successful.
Okay, so the joke is, of course, that we finish the 2018 election on Tuesday, Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, and you know, by sometime Wednesday afternoon, we start talking about the 2020 election, and candidates start preparing to run for president and all the various offices on the ballot. Is there anything that, when you look at what happened in Michigan in 2018 and even nationwide, that it says to you that could be a carryover, that could be something that does affect 2020, or you know, if we look back at 2016, it was a pretty different election from 2018. Do we wipe the slate clean, or are there things that we can link and say, oh, you know, if I were one side or the other, I see this in 2018, it means something in 2020.
I think our earlier discussion about how women are responding to Donald Trump is going to make a big difference in terms of the kind of candidate who's likely to win the Democratic nomination in 2020, the kind of legislation that the Democratic Party in the House is going to try to put forward. And the reaction to those kinds of dynamics from the real Trumpian conservative, as apart from the kind of the generic traditional Republican conservative, that if the Trumpian conservative is mobilized by what they see the House doing, then it could make a big difference. And we can kind of tie what goes on over the next couple of years and in 2020 to that. So it'll be interesting for me to see what happens with the House, what kind of legislation they're pursuing. And is this a realignment? Did 2016 represent a fundamental shift in the loyalties of some voters going from disengaged to regularly engaged? I think that's going to be an interesting question to look at.
You know, Pete's referring to the what the Democrats in the House do is an important reminder that elections are important, absolutely important, but so is governing. And what happens between elections is something that many of us as citizens don't pay very much attention to. It could very well be the case that the Democrats are able to sort of lay out an agenda, a policy agenda that you know, people can reflect on as they think about what happens in 2020 and what their decision is going to be in 2020, or it could very well be the case that a divided Congress decides essentially we're just going to wait till 2020. We are not going to address the nation's problems in any way, shape, or form, and focus only on the next election rather than on governing. And that's going to very much change voters' calculus, because then there's a lot of finger-pointing about who's responsible for that. I think that would be unfortunate, because it certainly seems as though, certainly here in the state of Michigan, where we will have divided government, and at the national level as well with divided government, there are a lot of problems that need to be solved. And it would be nice if our elected officials take their responsibility seriously to try to address those. But I do think Pete's right. If we think about some of the states that we expected to be the blue wall in 2016, to you know, for folks who use that that imagery of Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania in particular, states that went for Donald Trump by very narrow margins, Democrats did pretty well in those states in 2018. And so if those same voters stay mobilized to the extent they were this time around, and if they stay mobilized in the same partisan fashion as they did this time around, it's going to be difficult for a Donald Trump or any Republican to win the White House in 2020. Of course, that's looking at
through the prism
the election
of where we are right now.
Right now with an
external
without
events will
a
come
Democratic
along,
candidate. And we know that candidates make a difference. And sometimes we put too much stock in individual candidates and their characteristics. But it looks as though if this is a leading indicator for 2020, it's going to be tough for Republicans, at least in those states. And we know that the way the Electoral College operates, if Republicans can't win at least some of those states, it's difficult for them to win an Electoral College majority based on our expectations about the rest of the country.
Western Michigan University political science professors John Clark and Peter Wheelhauer, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank
Pleasure.
You.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.